to a demarcation that would control about 53% of the Gaza Strip has actually pushed that forward to between 65 and 70%. And Prime Minister Netanyahu himself has made it quite clear that he himself has been directing this, but we've also seen that movement precisely on the ground. Very little of this, if any, is actually being called out either by Mr. Mladenov or by the U.S. officials. And what they're actually doing is allowing Israel to keep bending the terms of the ceasefire, if not openly violating it, and such that they're recarving the Gaza Strip in such a way as to entrench their presence rather than to withdraw. And so the ceasefire terms itself, while it has certainly lessened the pace of the violence that we saw last year, the current conditions have now put about 2 million Palestinians in a humanitarian purgatory where their fate and their lives, their access to food and to clean water and other basic needs are being held hostage at the moment to the question around disarmament and around guns in the Gaza Strip. And major pressure needs to be pushed onto Israel and to the United States in order to flip those kind of priorities.
We're going to have to leave it there. I'm Jed Araki, senior Israel-Palestine analyst at the International Crisis Group, speaking to us from London. That does it for our show. I'll be in Kansas City on July 17th and 18th. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them, and not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
Hi, this is Al McFarlane, host of The Conversation with Al McFarlane. You're listening to 90.3 FM, KFAI, Minneapolis. So good afternoon, everybody. I'm Al McFarlane, and welcome to The Conversation with Al McFarlane, presented here live at the Paradise Room at Capri Theater. Capri Theater, one of the sacred civic spaces of this community, one of the most storied corridors in Minneapolis. So it's an honor to be back in this room with you. And Greg, you mentioned the origination story. I'm always proud to tell people that the very first ad in Insight, when it was a magazine, we launched in 1974, was bought by John Warder. John Warder was the president of First Plymouth Bank, which was the bank's entry into the near north side, and not Broadway, but Plymouth Avenue. And it was a landmark institution. John Warder, a landmark leader in our community, a legacy builder. And he encouraged the 23 or 24-year-old Al McFarlane, who came to him with a vision and a dream, an intention of being able to tell our story to ourselves and to the world in a way that reflected the truth of our reality, the value of our aspirations, and the commitment we would bring to being the best citizens we could be as community, but also creating a world in which we win. So you talked about collaboration. Collaboration is so important, and I simply want to restate that, reemphasize it, Greg, to say that the collaboration that you are leading is collaboration that will encourage, allow, support the outcome. And the outcome, Warren McLean, is that we're going to win. Our community is going to win. NEON, NAS, all of the organizations here, we're working together, as you said, and our goal is to win. And I tell you that victory is inevitable and imminent. It is at hand. So with that, thank you so much. And let me invite Sandra up. Come on up, Sandra. And as you're coming here, thank you so much for being here. You and I go back a long ways. I said to her before she got here that I remember often an interview I did with her, one of the first ones of several, where she and I were standing on the corner down here on maybe DuPont and West Broadway, and we were observing and talking about, and she was really preaching and teaching, sharing the pain she experienced on having to grieve over the murder of a young person on that corner. And she was both eloquent, passionate, compassionate, and clear And she spoke with an urgency about how we need to, how we must be involved in building and keeping and growing community. And Sandra, you've been doing that. You've been doing the work. So thank you so much for being here. And I'm pleased to have this conversation with you. Just so people know, we're taping this show here today at the Capri Theater, the wonderful Capri Theater. This is the Paradise Room, I believe. And paradise is where we belong.
Yes.
So this is the right place for this conversation. And this will be broadcast on our KFAI Conversations with Al McFarland program, also streamed across the multiple platforms, streamed on YouTube, the Insight News channel, streamed on the Black Press USA channel of YouTube. We'll be streaming it to LinkedIn and to our Facebook platforms as well. And we'll be asking all of you, when you see the program hit, to grab it and share it to your networks. We want to make these programs go viral, and you have a role to play in that. So watch for it. And when it comes to your inbox, you know what to do. Share it, like it, make a comment, create a conversation. Sandra, let's talk about you and your work. And what I often do before I ask you even to talk about NAS and the program about building wealth that we're going to focus on today, let's talk about Sandra Samuels. What's your story? How have you come to this work, and what have you learned in your journey so far?
Yeah, thank you, Al. It's so nice to be back here with you. We got a 30-year history. So great to be in conversation with you again. And Al, before we do that, so the Northside Achievement Zone is collaborative at the core. We know that parents can't do it alone, schools can't do it alone. You know, none of us can. We need each other, right? And Ujima, we need each other. And so we got a lot of NAS parents here. If the parents are in the house, could you say ho? And we got a whole heap of NAS partners in the house. If you're a NAS partner, say ho. Okay, we got NAS staff in the house. If you're part of the team, say ho. Okay, we got board members in the house, and one of our board members is actually on U.S. Bank. I mean, part of U.S. Bank as well, so we're in the family with U.S. Bank.
Right.
And so if you're a board member, say ho. Okay. I think, and if you Sandra's boyfriend, say ho. So I think I covered everybody. But yeah, so Al, I tell you, the I love that you start that way. So I'm 60 this year, and yes, and I love being 60.
Yeah.
And I'm going to make this the best year of my life, the best decade of my life. But I'm originally from New Jersey. And I tell everybody, you've heard a lot. You know, I was born in the same hospital as Queen Latifah and Whitney Houston. I rap, I don't sing. And what made me, the daughter of sharecropper, family of sharecroppers from Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina, who came up part of the big migration north with the promise, you know, of a better land and more opportunities. My father thought that, you know, nigger was what you just were called. He was in Georgia and I had a ninth grade education and then came up north when everybody, that part of that great migration. My mother went to a college near Birmingham, Alabama, and had to get smuggled out because the White Citizens League were coming to get all of the students who weren't from Alabama because they thought that they were like interlopers, like MLK.
Agitators.
Yes, they mm-hmm. thought they were agitators. So professors actually snuck her out of the house, out of Alabama. Mm-hmm. And she never returned to school. She was from a family of 11 and came north and worked as a nanny for a white family and then became an executive assistant, you know, after some years. My father got a break and became a longshoreman and was part of the union. And so, growing up in Newark, we left Newark. So here's a couple things we're just defining that have kind of led me to today. When I was in the third grade, we left Newark and moved to Scotch Plains, New Jersey, which is similar to Edina. And me and my sister integrated the school. And we came in the middle of the year, and most of the kids who graduated from high school were like 18 and 19. They were like 19 because whenever black kids moved to Scotch Plains, they would put them back a year. So they said, you know, we're going to need them to repeat their grade. And my mother said, oh, no, you test them. You don't track them. And if they can't pass, then of course. And so my sister was the great student. I was not. And, you know, I just saw the sea of white teachers that I knew expected me to fail. And I knew I was going to get my butt beat if I did, because then my mother was standing there. And but instead of hearing, well, my nickname is Sandy, instead of hearing the school system in Newark is not up to par with this school system here, is what they were saying. What I heard was, Sandy's not smart enough. Right? And that stuck with me my whole career, Al, like always second guessing myself. In fact, when I was in college and pledging Delta Sigma Theta, hey, soror, one of my sorors that I was online with, we were like, you know, what kind of animal would you be? What kind of car would, if you were a car, what would you be? And I loved BMWs, but my struggle with esteem, because I had borrowed beliefs of what a black girl and boy could be in America and inherited assumptions that were all wrong. But I had internalized it. And I remember saying to her, oh, I would be a low series BMW. Right. And she was like, what? Why would you say low series? And I was surprised that she was surprised. And it was in her reaction that I knew I shouldn't have said that. Right. But the steam was there. And then all these young black men that I knew and loved from Butch, both community members and cousin Skip, were being murdered routinely. And I kept saying, is this a black problem? Like, what's going on? My little mind couldn't figure it out. And then, you know, was able to go away to two historically black colleges and universities, Morgan State University, Clark, Atlanta University. Then I did Peace Corps in Africa for a couple of years. And that question, though, always drove me. And as I got older, I started understanding the systematic, the systemic racism, right? And the historic racism, the structural racism that created this insecure little girl, right? That I knew it was happening to so many of our kids and then the violence. And so I knew I wanted to be part of that solution because I knew that we were a worthy people, a dignified people with a rich history. And yeah, and that there was a system though that I needed to be a part of challenging. And so when I moved here after, you know, all of that and traveling around and my husband and I got married and we wanted to be in North Minneapolis. It was like we felt like our ancestors were calling us here and that they had prayed us here. And we wanted to be part of change, part of a community like you. Al, you've been on the North Side for how long?
Since 73.
You got us beat. But I wanted to be here with our people and part of the movement that had started well before us. But we wanted to be part of that chain of transition.
What a wonderful beginning. This is going to be an easy interview, you can tell. You know, so my job is simply to listen, and I love listening to you, Sandra. I said that before, and you certainly are going to fulfill that today. But let me ask you then to go from there to talk about the mission and the work. Yes. Let's do NAS 101.
Yes.
Give people a baseline. Then we'll move into the wealth project that you're moving into. And then finally, I'm going to come back to the personal side. You've mentioned your mom and your dad. Mm-hmm. You mentioned having worked in Africa. I want to talk about your sense of continuity, your sense of legacy, of history, how all of that feeds into how you assemble the world itself.
Yeah.
What kind of world are you creating for the NAS families, for the scholars, for the children? What are they going to inherit and what are they going to build? And where does that come from? So that's going to be the arc of this conversation.
Yes.
Let's do NAS 101.
Yeah, NAS 101. Okay, so we're in our 15th year of the Northside Achievement Zone. Yes. And we evolved from the Peace Foundation. I remember that public engagement, community empowerment. And so we were working on, my husband and I and a whole team of people, ending local violence. But we knew violence wasn't the problem, and that there was a solution, right? And there was a deeper problem. And that as we stood in the problem, the answers would come. And so it became really clear that, because most of the young people who were murdered and many who had done the murdering, not all, but had poor academic outcomes and had a lot of family challenges, right? Because we did vigils, so we got to talk. And amazing people, but who needed to be part of a strong community. And so when we heard about the Harlem Children's Zone in New York, place-based strategy, they have like 10,000 kids, $100 million budget, 2,000 employees. They have thousands of kids who have gone away to four-year colleges and come back, and now they're working in the Harlem Children's Zone. And the whole idea is that that low-income children should get the same thing that middle and upper-income kids do, that's what a community does, that we create this nurturing place for them. And so McKnight Foundation asked us if we were interested, because some folks from Minneapolis had gone out, and our community of workforce partners, school educational partners, early childhood, K-12, you know, colleges, all of them said, housing, career, said, yes, let's do it. We're not Harlem, but we have a vision for North Minneapolis too. And so this was a joint vision, Al, not just mine. And so we started building, like, how do you do this this wraparound, this ecosystem of support surrounding children at the center? And we call all our baby scholars. How do we create this ecosystem and a net so tight that they can't fall through, and that we secure their future, right? And work with their parents and their parents. The parents are the engine of all this work. I mean, we wouldn't be doing this if it wasn't for them. And they're doing a lot of leadership. So anyway, so we applied for a Obama grant. We received $28 million for 5 years in 2011 to build up the work. We went from a $1 million organization to a $6 million organization overnight. And many of the communities like ours from around the nation no longer exist. Some do. But we have had staying power here in North Minneapolis. And so our mission is to create a culture of achievement in North Minneapolis where we create generational wealth and all of our children are successful in school and in life. And that we do that through this ecosystem of support. And today we have about 59 employees. We have about 1,000 families, about 2,500 scholars. And we have put millions and millions of dollars into this community in terms of salary. Like half of our staff, more than half, work on the North Side, right, team? I'm sorry, live on the North Side. And so we've put a lot of money back into this community, you know, millions of dollars in early childhood scholarships. Because the whole idea, Al, is for NAS is that our strategic pathways to opportunities is human capital, so a great education, and that includes financial education, and then social capital, right? Being in the right networks, right? Sitting next to a young person whose parent could get you a job when you graduate, like what happens with many of our children here. And then financial capital. That's where Wealth Builds comes in. And that's only the last couple of years. And I do want to thank U.S. Bank for being the first organization to say we believe in that model and to fund it to the tune of six figures. And just so grateful to them. So thank you so much.
Let me say that this is community, this is family, and you all can talk back. If you like something, say it. You know, shout it out. If you don't like it, say that too. Yeah. But we're all here as family, having a family conversation. So we're going to be ourselves.
Yes.
You be yourself. And we're all going to be who we're supposed to be. So this is a, you know, a place where we can be together and be real. So community is the key.
Yes.
Being together and learning how to be together and to learn how to see ourselves expansively, to not be siloed.
Yes.
The power of the vision of NAS, from my point of view, is the notion that we have an obligation to think expansively and to look at all of the elements of what it takes to be an individual, a sister, brother, mother, father, child, a neighbor, and all that adding up to being community.
Yeah.
All of that adding up to developing a sense of purpose, a sense of mission, a sense of not having to apologize. You described a situation where you were underselling yourself.
Yeah.
You were choosing to describe yourself from a deficit mode.
Yes.
You kind of wanted to be a BMW,
right.
But you were a low-end BMW, right?
Right.
And so how do we combat that kind of pervasive and immersive dampening of our potential and of our vision? We don't see ourselves as masters of the universe.
Right.
But we must change that.
Gotta change
that. And I believe that's what you're doing. Talk about that. How does that show up in how you interact with parents, their children, their neighbors, your employees? It's so important to me, Sandra, that you talked about the millions that you invest in community. Not that you're investing it in project this, project that, which you are.
Right.
But you said salaries.
Mm-hmm.
People are getting paychecks,
right.
And they're buying homes,
yes.
And buying cars,
yes.
And sending their kids off to college.
Yes.
So that's the economy.
That's the economy.
And I'll stop with this. I tell people that one of the things we need to do, my grandma in Kansas City said to me, Al, boy, mind your business. mind your business, right? And so what does that mean in 2026 or 2015? It means my education is my business.
Amen.
Let's look at the process, the institution, the systems of education as businesses and see where our power and profit lie, where our building of wealth can come from the institutions, from minding our business. If our business is health, North Minneapolis is known as ground zero for all of the health disparities that we decry. But we can turn that around to a plan of action and work that we benefit from by bringing solutions,
yes.
And having that investment reward us. Yes. Talk about that.
Yeah, Al, you know, I can listen to you talk all day long. I mean, it's so powerful, Al. But yeah, you know, there's a education reformer out of Chicago, deceased now, named John Dewey. And he was quoted as saying, what the best and brightest parent wants for his or her own child, that must the community want for all its children.
Mm-hmm.
Anything less is naive and unlovely and destroys our democracy. And so, you know, Al, it's just, we want what everybody wants for their children. Right? And like, we want them to succeed and to flourish, and we know they've all been born with purpose. And sometimes poverty gets in the way. Sometime, again, the borrowed beliefs we get from America about what we're capable of or not capable of, that we, and sometimes I think, I know a lot of us are pretending that we are confident. You grow into that. I'm sorry, you grow into it. And so it takes us being together and working together on a mission. And for the Northside Achievement Zone, our mission are our children and their success, right? For us, it's like that is, we say, one of our mantras at NAS is that we're powering purpose and potential. Right? That we want to be the engine behind that. We want to help our children know how wonderful they are. You know, I tell you, one of the things that I think about, and my children have done well. I have one is in London. She graduated from the London School of Education, Northsider. The other one is a voice actor living in LA with their own business, you know, and so they've done really well. But I know the one thing that I wish I had done differently is taught them how to talk to themselves and how to challenge those thoughts that come into their head around who they are, what their identity is. So we're creating identity on the North Side, right? And in fact, Al, it starts when they're babies. So we have this pre-birth to profession pipeline that we're focused on. And so pre-birth, we got doulas working with our moms and dads, you know, home visitors. And then we're working with the K through 12 schools, and we have after school programs. And then we're working with workforce organizations, you know, and even our teens at Cookie Card and so on. And then we have a whole host of family education classes from, yes, and we have facilitators here. Some of our moms became facilitators and actually teach other parents. And also this doing away with borrowed beliefs, and it's not just creating our own story. We're standing on story, powerful story. But we have to, in every generation, we've got to move that forward. We've got to make sure it's not forgotten. So when a family joins NAS and they go through our College Bound babies class, thank you, facilitator. one of the first things they get is a class, a 12-week parenting education class for parents who have children 0 to 3. One of the first things that they get, or at graduation, and we have a graduation coming up, is, Al, can you hold that up while I talk? They get this t-shirt that says college graduate. And that's the year that our youngest scholar will graduate from a four-year college. Right?
2048.
Yep, 2048. And it's like, and it's like, Al, when you, like, when you look at a baby and say, and they're wearing this t-shirt. Mm-hmm. And at one point, many of our parents, even if they have four kids, they would be like, okay, so Jamal graduating in 2048, and let's see, and Aaliyah is graduating in 2040. Like, they like knew the dates. Like, when you start naming what your future is going to be, it can't not happen. And so now, so education is core for us. That's what we're building on, Al. And so when you talk about, like, how we do this, a child understanding their innate efficacy around their intelligence is critical. And when schools aren't working, when the educational system is not working for them, and it is failing them, again, like me, I didn't hear that school isn't working. I heard you're not working.
Right.
You're not smart enough.
Right.
That's the message we're sending them. And so we're working and doing whatever it takes to do high dosage tutoring, Al, because we know that works for middle class families. We're like doubling down on that. We have one of our tutoring partners here, Julia from Serve Men, but we're doubling down on it at the schools, making sure that after school programming has that educational component. And the early, we've done millions of dollars in early childhood scholarships so that our families can go to high quality early learning centers. Got some of those partners in here too, because they've got to start off strong, right, when they go to kindergarten. And so we have that whole pipeline, and then the parenting classes, the policy, but now with the money. So can I jump to the wealth bills? So what we know with all, and this is in partnership with Harlem Children's Zone in New York, and they are expanding this to 10 cities, and Harlem has had mad success. And we were chosen as one of the two first cities that they were expanding in. It's a 12 million dollar initiative, and Harlem Children's Zone is investing $6 million in that. And again, our first local investor was U.S. Bank. And what that means is we're building on the education pipeline, making sure our children get a solid pre-K through college education. But then on top of that, the human capital, social capital, financial capital, we're doing financial literacy and education, and then also the asset boost. Because what all the data says, Al, and we're doing $1,500 college scholarships, college savings accounts, and we got a couple of our moms who they have those, yes. And then we're doing $510,000 investment accounts that are being invested in New York by black money managers. And these are all for scholars who are kindergarten through eighth grade. They have to go to one of our schools or early childhood centers, because we got a, one of the data points for the way NAS is working is that more NAS is better. So a parent in our schools, living on the north side, doing family academy classes, you know, and the scholar going to to one of our after-school programs, they just do better.
The more you give, the more you get.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so the $10,000 that's being invested, and we have 500 of those, and we've given out over a million right now in those accounts. But the young person can't touch it until they're 25. And they can only use it on asset building things. And they can even go through and they don't have to take it out at 25.
Have any of those come to fruition yet?
No, because we just started. Okay. Yeah, okay. We're like in our second year.
Okay.
And they can't, and we're giving them, we started with kindergartners, first and second graders. And they can only use it for a house, going back to school, starting a business.
But what must it feel like for a 5-year-old to know that he or she has an account with $500 or $1,000 or $10,000 in it?
Both. $500 and then $10,000.
And $10,000. So that's got to be a powerful idea for a child who doesn't, in general, have the conversation about money in her or his environment. This is changing the game completely. Yeah.
And then our parents are talking to their children about money and about income and about savings and reducing debt and retirement, you know, and asset producing things. Like, so the conversations are now happening, you know, as well.
So let me do this. I wanted to ask you, so when did NAS start again? Good year?
15 years ago. So
2011. So when you showed up, maybe the year or two or three, when you were planning and moving towards NAS, give me an idea of how you described North Minneapolis in our community. What was the narrative that you observed? What did you see?
Yeah.
And I want you to say that and then reflect on what you see today.
Right.
What's been the consequence?
Yeah.
How what you saw motivated your direction to create NAS and the opportunity, how that's evolved. You've discussed it already, but you can go into more.
Yeah.
And where do we stand now? And obviously the end question is where do we go in the future?
Right.
And we're on that track with the whole notion of the Wealth Build Initiative.
Yeah.
So go ahead.
Yeah. I would say, you know, all of our families, all the residents of North Minneapolis, and I don't care what the behavior is, are beautiful and powerful and have so much, you know, potential and just everybody has a purpose.
So you're saying that, but the public persona
no,
of our community at that time
no,
was
right.
that North Minneapolis was a hellhole.
Exactly.
A place
exactly.
that was falling apart
exactly.
and out of control and the kids out of control. But you didn't see it that way.
Right, right. And now that's the thing. That's what I'm saying. So, and here we go with borrowed beliefs. But anyway, because then you start acting out.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes if you have a certain identity, it drives your actions,
mm-hmm.
right? And so it what, like high crime, don't go to North Minneapolis, for sure don't move there.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of middle-class black friends
mm-hmm.
who said they would not live in North Minneapolis, right? And that the schools were terrible, you weren't gonna get an education, you'd get shot if you were here, and just that there was nothing, businesses were not thriving, right? This was just not a place to raise your kids. And to have a family. And not true,
mm-hmm.
but that was the narrative
yep.
and that too many of us bought into, by the way.
Whose interest did that serve? Why did we adopt that? Why did we believe these negative things about ourselves?
Yeah, yeah. I think, Al, it has everything to do with not understanding history
mm-hmm.
and the historical nature of what has caused the gaps that we're seeing in education and home ownership, you know, and income, right? Mental health, like we could just go maternal health. Like there's a gap, like in every sphere of life. And in fact, if we eradicated the wealth gap, that would add $5 trillion to our economy in 5 years. $5 trillion. But I think, Al, it's not just the broader community not understanding the history of what got us here. Like that we're on the tails of, you know, slavery and then Jim Crow.
Mm-hmm.
And then even when the Social Security Act was passed, it wasn't for occupations that our families were in,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, you know, maids and janitors and the folks on the train, you know, none of the industries that we were in couldn't get. And then of course couldn't get Social Security. And then the GI Bill, right? Coming back from from the war. White men could get loans to, and then, but black men couldn't. And then the redlining, right? That we couldn't get mortgages. I mean, like, I could, like, there's so many reasons. And when you understand them, you understand that it's not about the people, it's about a system that we inherited, Al. And so I think so nobody benefits.
And as you said, we're being told it's you.
Right.
You are deficient, but it's not you at all.
Yeah, when you don't understand the historical nature of this and the persistent nature of it, right? And the systems that, and I tell you, the thing that I struggle with so much is that so the achievement gap, I'm gonna get back to education. Mm-hmm. And who it benefits and who it doesn't and why things aren't changing. Of all the places in all of the country, Minnesota is most stubborn when it comes to a willingness to educate all of its children. And so we talk every year about the achievement gap. In fact, many foundations no longer fund education because they put so much money into it and no return. But here's one gap in education. Last year, for Minneapolis public schools, whereas 75% of white kids were reading at grade level, only 17% of black kids were reading at grade level. So that's the gap. And then on the north side, just 10% were reading at grade level. So 90% not, mm-hmm. Right? If white kids in this state, if only 10% were reading at grade level, this would be done.
It would be a problem.
It would be overdone, finished. Mm-hmm. Right? But there are so many things that we could change to make the education work for all, make the economy work for all, that we have been unwilling to do, Al, because it benefits the adults. Kids don't vote, right? And then white kids are doing okay. Mm-hmm. So then what you hear is, well, it's not our system, it's those kids. Mm-hmm. So those other people's kids. And that's the thing, Al, that we have to keep working on to really transform this state. And we're called to, those of us in North Minneapolis, we're called to be change makers, not just here, Al, but I think God has called us. I think black people in general. but God has called us to really with all of our struggles, with understanding what it feels like to not be believed in, to have all the things come against you. We should be the most loving, the most understanding, and the most persistent, and leaders of making sure justice happens everywhere for everyone. And so we have a calling, and we were made for these times, and we are in Minneapolis for a reason today. Mm-hmm. Life at its longest is brief, mm-hmm. And we're here. Why? And Al, you were saying it earlier, like it's here to do the thing. We're here to do the thing.
Yeah. So, you know, I love that you talked about wrapping around the life of a child before the child is born.
Yes.
And you're talking about sort of some broad systemic statistical situations that place us where we are at disadvantage, but you're also talking about despite that.
Yes, yes.
That notwithstanding, we continue to rise. Yes. And that you have a different story to tell.
Yes.
You said we were at the tail end of slavery and that, in a sense, as a community, we're at the tail end of the nation's sense of self.
Yes.
That's from their point of view.
Yes.
But from our point of view, we remain, and we always have been, the center
yes.
of hope, of
yes.
truth, and democracy.
Yes. Yes.
And I think that we simply
yes.
have to change the conversation,
we got
to
conversation.
Talk to each other,
right.
to our children,
right.
about the glorious work
yes.
that we've done, the
yes.
power that we've demonstrated in our ability to withstand the impossible,
yes.
The effort to eradicate, current efforts to erase our history
yes.
and our presence.
Yes.
It's not going to work.
Not going to work.
We're going to be here. We're going to be here, right? And that's the story. We have to say more.
Yes.
Every day, all day, to ourselves, to our children, and to the rest of the world, that in the sense of mission that you've described, Sandra Samuels, our description and the power of our voice will not only save us, it has to save us, but the saving us will save everybody.
Yes.
That's Amen. The mission.
Amen.
That's the mission.
Yeah.
And we're here for that reason.
We're here for that reason.
And we can do it.
We can do it.
And NAS is doing it.
Yeah, thank you.
And building wealth is one of the tools.
It's one of the tools.
You've got to, and you are, realigning, reconfiguring how we think about money and wealth.
Yes.
We've been victimized there as well. Mm-hmm. Number one, been made to feel afraid of budgeting,
yes.
of discussing money, discussing finances, believing that finance was somebody else's business
right.
and somebody else's domain,
yes.
but that it's okay for us to be locked in poverty.
Yes.
It is not okay.
It's not.
You know, that's not who we are. And so you are creating pathways now to change the narrative, change the perception, change the outcomes. And the outcomes you are working on are ones that allow us to be our true selves.
Yes.
Go from there.
Yeah. And I want to acknowledge, too, there's a lot of that's the thing. I see this movement of so many Black folks talking about wealth now,
mm-hmm.
right? Not just income,
mm-hmm.
and what it looks like to have wealth and how you retain, how you get it, retain it, grow it, you know, and also how you remain a good person, because
mm-hmm.
there's a lot of crazy people
sure.
with money. And so one of the people, is Kenya McKnight still here? Yeah, there go Kenya. Kenya is my inspiration. She started the Black Women's Wealth Alliance.
Kenya's my cousin.
Oh, yeah, okay. Cousin, inspiration.
That's right, yeah.
Right? And so, you know, has Zara here, you know, and just doing incredible things. But she was one of the first ones I heard really talking about,
mm-hmm.
like, we got to talk about wealth.
Mm-hmm.
We have to talk about what that means in terms of our community and not be afraid of the conversation. And even when you hear her talk about it, it does feel like, of course, why of course, Kenya? we can all do this. And that's what we are working on at NAS, Al, is through the financial education, through internships, apprenticeships, mentorship. Another thing we're partnering with U.S. Bank on is they have an online curriculum for kids called Greenlight. So that's being used at Ascension, where they're, you know, talking about savings and piggy banks and investment. And we have an investment club at Camden High. We're going to be expanding that, where kids are actually investing money. We do a deposit day at another partner bank, and we're going to have another one coming up that everybody comes into the bank. And because we want people to get comfortable with being in the institution, with opening accounts.
That's right.
And with the college savings account, we also incentivize that. When a family comes to a financial literacy class, they get a stipend. They get an incentive. When coming to opening up an account, they'll get an incentive. We have done one-to-one matches with families who were in a savings program. So we've had a universal guaranteed income pilot where 11 families received $15,000 over 18 months, right? And we hope to continue that, because what we're seeing around the country is that when you bundle capital for communities that have been left out of the American wealth, that it changes the trajectory. Like, the research is proving it out.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if a child has even $500 in a college savings account, they are five times more likely to graduate college.
Mm.
Right? Just $100, right? And so we have a vision on a policy level that the city of Minneapolis would start having college savings accounts for every child born in this city. They do it in St. Paul.
That's right, yeah.
And then baby bonds. So baby bonds are basically, they're like, if you've heard of Trump accounts, but baby bonds, every baby, and Vermont is one state that are just killing it. I was on a Zoom yesterday with the treasurer of Vermont and a bunch of other organizations, but they're doing baby bonds. They're doing baby bonds, I think, in like 20 other states. But there's an account that is invested in for children. And the same thing with the Youth Opportunity Fund that I was mentioning.
Mm-hmm.
But they, and usually at the end, they from the initial investment, $25,000-$30,000 that the young person can withdraw. Ours is they can't do it until 25. Baby bonds is 18. And so, you know, having, because we need a policy move as well. So, you know, everything can't happen on the ground. We actually need policies to change, right, to unleash capital, to really make right the wrongs of the past so that our community can succeed with our initiative, you know, and our action, but also with systems that are equitable, unlike has been the case so far.
How many families are you dealing with NAS and with the new Build Wealth program, the Wealth Build program? I think, if I remember correctly, when NAS was created, you picked out a geography of X number of blocks and it had X number of people. Talk about that again. Now that translates into both the scholars and the children and families that are part of the project going forward.
Yeah, yeah. So we did have a geographic location of a certain number of blocks. It didn't work. Right away, it didn't work. Because you'd be in a school, and it's like, okay, so, you know, so Jaquan gets to be in NAS because he lives across West Broadway on the south side. But, you know, Amelia doesn't, and she lives on the south side, but they're in the same classroom all on the north side. So we scrapped that like a year in, Al, and now it's any family on the north side.
Okay.
And currently we're working with 1,000 families, about 2,500 scholars, 0 to 18. We're going to go up to 25. And we want to add, in the next 4 years, 3,000 more scholars. Okay. So right now about 2,500, but we want to hit that to create a real tipping point of who we're working with. Now, all of those won't be wealth bills. Mm-hmm. Right now, for wealth bills, for the scholars, it's the 1,500 that would receive financial capital. But again, we want to have some policy moves that help us expand it to all the families that are in NAS.
Okay. I'm going to have questions in a few minutes. Before we do, let me pivot back to the original question I asked about who you are, Sandra, and whose shoulders you stand on. You mentioned your mother and your father, their stories, but you went to Africa. Yes. What did you learn about yourself in Africa? Have you done genealogy personally? Yes. Does it matter to you,
yes.
Your lineage? Talk
yes.
about that, if you would.
Yeah. Wow, Al. So I was in Botswana, just north of South Africa, and it was a really crystallizing experience for me, and there was such affinity, right? Like first of all, to be in the majority, and I had my hair in a short natural, and so if I didn't talk, people didn't know I was American, and I just fit in. Right. And it just felt so good to be like in the majority and just like everything. And in fact, my team that I went over with, there were like 11 of us. I was the only African-American in the group. And we used to have to go out in the village and speak Setswana. And all of the villagers would come up to me and say, you're going to learn it fast, which they were wrong now, but, you know, you're going to learn. But there was just this knowing.
Yeah.
Even and the cultural differences were real.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But there was just this knowing. And I knew, and then I got a chance to go to Senegal and travel around. And I went to Gorée Island. Mm-hmm. And so it was. I was filled with so much pride, you know, and just encouragement of, you know, there, what is going to stop us?
Yeah.
If that didn't.
Yeah, we can't be stopped.
Oh, my gosh.
You tell that story. I remember, Don, the first time I went to Jamaica, where my family, my mom and dad, my dad's side is from Jamaica, Cuban-born, but raised in Jamaica from before. And I discovered on a street corner in Kingston, my first day there, that as long as I kept my mouth shut, I like everybody else, right? But the minute I opened my mouth up, they said,
yeah, you're so, American.
And the local story is that when my family moved from Kansas City, where I was born, to Worthington, Minnesota, my youngest brothers and sisters were all born there and grew up speaking Worthington. right? It's a different kind of language.
Okay.
Yeah. And when my father's job moved him back to Kansas City, they went back to our old neighborhood, a black neighborhood where we spoke black.
Yes.
And my sisters and brothers discovered the same thing. You in the hallway at Central High School or whatever school you're at, and as long as you keep your mouth shut, you just flow in with the flow.
Right, right.
But the minute you say, hi, guys, everything stops. That's it.
You're out.
Now, empty your pockets. you don't belong here.
Right.
So the question is, learning something about who we are and seeing ourselves more globally.
Yeah.
My last comment here is that when I grew up in Kansas City, my mom and dad would say, you can go to the alley, this block, don't cross that street. So my whole world was the neighborhood. I tell you now, because of my travel and because of my access to the world through the digital, digisphere, through technology, now the world is my neighborhood. The world belongs to me. So how do we, and I'm asking you because I know you're doing this, encourage our children to see that they are the owners of existence itself? What do you think? What are the five-year-olds that you're working with now thinking about the future? What are you building for them? And as you watch them, what do you predict they're going to build for the world that is coming? What do you think?
Oh my gosh. Our kids are so limitless. It's incredible. And like with our moms right here, right? Their kids are okay. Like they know all about parenting education, what discipline is for, you know, they're talking to them about college, about wealth. I think what's happening on the North side is that there is a movement, right? Of parents, of adults, who recognize that all of our children have purpose, Al, and we are pouring into them in that way. And we're doing it as an ecosystem, right? Wherever they go, there's an expectation that they are going to succeed. There's an expectation that they are not alone and that they are going to, that we are powering their purpose and their potential. And you know, I'm really, I know there's a lot of dangers to AI, but I want us as a African-American community to start talking about that more, like really, really in earnest, around how it can transform, it can democratize education. Because with AI, every young person, and many of our young people in NAS are like a critical mass or like a grade behind. Like they're because of COVID and you know, teacher strike and George Floyd uprising and the aftermath and, you know, Operation Metro Surge, all of these reasons, right? But we know that with AI, with that technology, every child could have their own tutor. Now we got to put guardrails on, don't get me wrong. Every teacher could have their own assistant. And the tutor could individualize your learning and the teacher's getting support for that. And there are places in the country where it's really working. And I, like Al, for our kids, I want to, how do we utilize, because it's not going away. AI is not going away, right? We can put our head in the sands all day long. And my thing is, how can we be on the right side of change?
That's right. How do we create what is being called AI justice?
Yes.
Algorithmic justice. How do we use our affinity for the notion of justice and apply it to the future in technology?
Oh,
we're doing that. AI justice. So listen, we're going to ask if there's questions or comments from the audience. As anybody who wants to come to the side here for a question or comment, say your name and raise the question or say the comment. Before we do, Sandra, let's say it's now, what's today's date? May 5th, May 6th, 2026. Teleport your mind and our spirits to May 6th, 2126.
Oh, gosh, okay.
Today is May 6th.
I'm dead. Okay, bye. No, I got you.
Today, no, we can go anywhere now.
We can go anywhere.
Right, we can go forward,
that's right.
Go backwards.
That's like
right now, we're looking at 100 years from now.
Yes.
And, you know, as we look at each other and we say, I say, Sandra, we won.
Yeah.
We won.
Yeah.
How does it look? Describe this neighborhood after we have won. Describe the world after we have won.
Wow. That's so powerful, Al. So first of all, we'd have a community that was built on this understanding of who we were, our identity, as divine, as worthy, as capable, and like this sense of identity would be driving everything we build and do. So we would have the best schools, first of all, like pre-K all the way through to college. But the schools in the neighborhood would be schools that have waiting lists because everybody wants to go there, right? Like the best schools, everybody knows it. And the kids there have the latest technology and they are, digital natives and they're looking towards the future and they care about community, right? And they care about their brother and sister and the young boy or girl standing next to them, right? And that our businesses, oh my gosh, our businesses. Like we got a jazz club over there and it has the best wine, a lot of red wine. And then we have, you know, just a skating ring for the kiddos. We got a bowling alley. We have a dry cleaners, a shoe repair, a bookstore. Oh my gosh, we got bookstores. And coffee shops. I mean, just, and then we have businesses that we own, real estate developments that we own, homes that are beautiful and cared for, and where we're taking care of each other, right? That is not just about my success, it's about our success, and that's how we roll.
And we're having conversations, and the conversations are such that a person showing up would say, I just met some philosophers, that the language we speak is the language of philosophy, the language of understanding and knowing what it means to be, right? You are bringing that, we are bringing it. Sandra Samuels, thank you so very much. Thank you for all of the NAS parents and NAS families and all of your partners. Thanks to you, Greg, and all your team at U.S. Bank. Thanks for making this program possible. Obviously, thanks to the Capri. This is a wonderful venue for this conversation. And I want to shout out Sharon Smith Akinsanya, the Ray McKenzie Group, and DeVar McGee, Big Bar Productions, for doing the video work. And to all of you who have come today, we hope we can continue this series in the future. It's worth doing. Thank you so much. I'm Al McFarland. We'll see you next time.
Bobby, I don't know, but whatsoever I play, it's got to be funky.
Yeah.
One, two, three, make it funky.
Make it funky. Huh. Make it funky.
I got to
make it funky. Make it funky. Make it funky.
Tell me, ain't it?
Make it funky. Make it funky.
snake. Good straight. Crack and break.
You are tuned into Fresh Air Community Radio 90.3 FM, KFEI, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and around the world at KFEI.org. Non-commercial, community-powered radio. Stay